So, the title for this evening's Dhamma Talk will be, exciting moment, isn't it? Wondering what the Dhamma Talk is going to be. Sometimes exciting for me too, because sometimes I don't know what I'm going to talk about. But today, I'm going to recycle a talk I gave over in Toronto. Sometimes when you give talks, they give you the subjects. And quite often, you want to have the subject, but give it a different slant, an angle which people haven't heard before, so as to not just tell people what they already know, but to take one's understanding of the nature of the world, and especially you, to a deeper level, so that that understanding can equip one to deal better with the problems and difficulties of life, so not just with philosophy, but also just with experiential strategies for life. And they asked me to talk in Toronto about the first factor of the Eightfold Path, which is called right view. And it's a great difference here, because right view does not mean right dogma. Sometimes people think, oh, well, what is right view? I mean, you've got to believe this, and you've got to believe that, and you've got to do this, and this is the right way of doing the ritual. For example, when you light the candles, you must always light the candle on your left, which is the Buddha's right, and don't do it the other way around. I do it the other way around, just because I'm rebellious. But because it also doesn't have any meaning at all. So right view is not right dogma. So this is not just some other sort of religion, which is, you know, there to sort of make you be able to recite some sort of catechism or some list of Buddhist teachings, so this is what it means. Because sometimes people use what we call views to actually almost enslave people. So telling them what to believe rather than telling them how to look at life and how to react to life, how to be in life, and how to make a much better job of your life, and even to get to that place where you can liberate yourself from life and be at peace and content no matter whatever happens, which is what I was talking about earlier. I know when people ask that question, is Buddhism a religion? I often tell them, yes, Buddhism is a religion for tax purposes. It's a philosophy if you want to study at university. It's a psychology if you're counseling somebody. In other words, you can use it for whatever you really want, because it's this great set of tools which help with life. But today, we're talking about right view. We're not sort of saying that right view is going to be a set of beliefs or frameworks which you have to believe in, but rather just a way of looking. An idea of right view is actually telling you, number one, where to look, and number two, how to look. So the where and how of views, not the what is the view. So we're not talking about what you're supposed to find out, but where you're supposed to look and how you're supposed to look. And if one gets that message into your brain, it makes life far easier. I have just come back. Sometimes I do these things because I'm really trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records. Because I just came back from Toronto in Canada. I was only went there for 7 days. Actually, 11 days I've been away. But 4 of those days were travelling. Even I worked out that I arrived back here in Nolomar at 4:30 this afternoon. That's Friday. And I left Toronto, and this is Perth time, not Toronto time, left Toronto at 5, the house I was staying at, 5 p.m. on Wednesday evening. So that's from 47 and a half hours from door to door. Now that's a crazy thing to do. So I'm both jet-lagged, tired, I don't know where I am, but nevertheless, who cares? Now, how can you do these sorts of things? And the main thing is to stop worrying about them and stop thinking about them and stop complaining about them. You've got to be somewhere at some time. If you're not meditating in your cave in Bodhidharma Monastery Serpentine, you might as well be meditating at 30,000 feet. And actually, the air is really nice at 30,000 feet, if they'd only open the windows, but they wouldn't do that for me. But nevertheless, you've got to be meditating somewhere. So why not meditate wherever you are? You can always be at peace no matter what happens. And this is the most important thing with right view. It does not matter what you're doing, where you are, or what you're experiencing. The whole point with right view is to, how are you reacting to this? What are you doing with this? Number one, to get right view, you should be looking at your reactions to life. Not what actually life is, but how are you reacting to this? What is your relationship between you and life in this moment? And if you actually put your attention and your view in this, you know, this wonderful place, the space between you and life, you know, the reaction, how you're dealing with it, how you're appreciating or how you're complaining about it, then there you will find what the Buddha meant as right view. That's where the so-called Four Noble Truths lie. That's where the karma exists, in the space between you and your whatever you're experiencing. And too often in life, I found out that people, sometimes they put these terrible ideas. Well, number one, they're not looking where the action is. A good example of that is getting angry at somebody. Whenever you get angry at someone, where are you looking? Where is your view focused? When you're angry at someone, you are focused on the trigger of that anger. In other words, you know, your wife, or your husband, or your kids, or your boss at work, or the government, or whatever else it is you'll get angry at. Your focus is on what you think to be the cause of the anger, then, their fault, and you need to tell them off. When you're not viewing in the right place, you'll find that anger is never understood, you find the solutions are never really solved, and that life gets worse and worse and worse. How many times have people solved problems with anger? Sometimes you get temporary solutions if they're afraid of you, but long term, and actually most times even temporary solutions don't exist, you get worse and worse, it just makes things worse. So instead of focusing on the other person next time you get upset, not even focusing on yourself and feeling guilty, we have this beautiful way of focusing. The right view is, what is my relationship with this experience? Now, why get angry at that experience and get upset at it? When you look in the right place, you'll find that reactions like anger are just so dysfunctional that only a stupid person would get angry. You know that story, which I don't know when the last time I told it, of the man who went to the market for eggs? Is that 2 weeks ago? Was it? Was it? Close, so 3 weeks ago or something. I'll tell it very briefly then. It's a great little story. If you haven't heard this before, guy had afternoon off work, wife was busy making dinner, she needed some eggs, so she asked her husband, "Darling, I need some eggs, can you go to the market and get me some eggs?" And he was a very nice guy. He said, yeah, because he'd been to the Buddhist Society for a few weeks, so you know he knew about good karma. So he's a good guy, went to the market, said, "But first of all, I need instructions. I've never been to the market before. I don't know what to do or where to go." So she gave him the basket, gave him some money, and it gave him instructions. And so off he went to the market to buy some eggs. When he got to the market, I'll tell it very briefly, the guy came up to him, started abusing him, cursing him, telling all sorts of terrible names. He got so embarrassed because, number one, he didn't even know the guy. "I have done nothing wrong," he thought. You recognize that when someone gets angry at you and scolds you, you think, "Why me? I haven't done anything wrong." And number two, it was in public. It's very embarrassing when people scold you and tell you off in public. And he was so upset of being treated unfairly by someone he never knew, and also in the middle of the marketplace. You can't get more public than that. So he was so upset, he turned around and went home. And as soon as he got back in the door, his wife said, "Darling, you're back early." And he said, "Yes! I never want to go to that stupid market ever again." He never said stupid, say something else, but this is on camera. There's many children here today and listening. I do have to behave sometimes. And he was so upset, wife calmed him down. When he was calmed down, what had happened. He told him about this young man who had come and abused him and cursed him, and she recognized him. Oh, it's him. Because that young man, she told her husband, is brain damaged. The poor boy had an accident when he was very small. He hit his head and he damaged his brain. So he will never be able to go to school. So he won't be able to get any job. He probably won't even be able to find a wife or bring up a family. The poor boy is brain damaged. And so he hangs around the market every day. Sometimes he abuses me. Sometimes he scolds somebody else. But you don't have to worry. He's just crazy. And as soon as the husband heard he'd been abused by a crazy person, by someone who'd been brain damaged because he hit his head, all his resentment disappeared. He wasn't upset anymore. And when the wife saw that, she said, "Darling, I still need those eggs." Which, I don't know why that always gets a laugh. But anyway, "Darling, I still need those eggs." So he said, "Certainly, I'll go back to the market for you. You don't need to worry about the crazy guy." "No, I won't." So he went back into the market. He was abused by the crazy guy again, calling him names, shouting at him, cursing him. But it didn't matter anymore, because he knew the guy was crazy. He could buy his eggs and walk out the market being cursed and abused and scolded throughout the whole purchase. And it didn't matter. And the moral of that story is, if your husband comes home one night and starts getting angry at you and cursing you and scolding, you don't need to feel upset. All you need to know is he probably hit his head that day. He's been brain damaged. Fortunately, only temporarily. Because the Buddha called anger temporary insanity. So anyone, if your wife sort of starts shouting and scolding you, never mind, darling. Temporary insanity, you're going to be sued. Because no one in their right mind would use anger to somebody else, especially someone they love. Because it's a dysfunctional method of achieving your so-called ends. Instead, when we look between ourselves and the so-called trigger of our anger, instead of that person, we don't look at the person, that stupid guy who's abusing me, we don't look at ourselves, why me? We look at how we're reacting to life. And if we can only see how we're reacting, if we put our view there, then it's amazing just how you can deal with life in such a positive way and also understand the traditional view of the right view, what actually suffering is and what the cause of suffering is and what the end of suffering is and how it feels to end suffering. Because all that happens in that space between you, the observer, the experiencer, and whatever you have to experience. Which is why I can do these long trips without getting worried at all. Who cares where, however far you're going or what you have to do next? You just go and do it. And anyway, have good fun as a monk. Very rare that a monk gets some excitement. But yesterday morning, or somehow, I'm not quite sure what's yesterday and what's the day before, because I'm crossing date lines, completely jet lagged. I was in Los Angeles Airport. Just arrived and checked in for the connecting flight, you know, back to Singapore and then to Perth. And then all these policemen came in. And they cleared out the whole airport. There was a bomb in Terminal 3 of Los Angeles yesterday. And so all the police came in with their machine guns. And was I scared? Actually, I thought it was really funny because these Los Angeles, the LAPD, I think it's called, Los Angeles policemen, they're not like in the movies. They were fat. And I saw these two policemen trying to run up the stairs, you know, with their machine guns, trying to stop terrorists. And the terrorists would have probably run away before these two fat guys got up with them. You know, there's only two flights of stairs, and they had to pause halfway up. So what a wonderful, enjoyable experience that was for me. But now, I've got very good karma. I must admit, there may be just, you know, things which I've done in this life and the past. Because when they cleared out the whole airport, you know, this is not sort of Perth Airport, it's a dinky, it's a huge airport, very, very busy. And these police came in there, and they had all their guns and their telephones, and they're keeping people out and trying to check people. And you couldn't get out of the airport. You couldn't get in. It was completely isolated for about 2 or 3 hours. You know where I was caught? I was stuck. Just where they were serving food at lunchtime. With a very nice disciple. So there I was. All that action was going on down. I could actually see it because we're up the mezzanine floor. And I was very happy having my lunch. Watching all the action. It's like a TV lunch, but it wasn't really a TV. It was real action. And I must really admit that I was very, very impressed with these sniffer dogs. They took the dogs all around because this was a real... Actually, they found the bomb, I was told afterwards. It was only a small bomb. They found it and defused it. But it was a real bomb, apparently, so I heard. And they had all these dogs, you know, sniffing around. And I was really impressed with the discipline of the dogs in the LAPD. Not the sort of the policemen, they were, you know, overweight, but the dogs. Because they were sniffing, you know, right along the food court where I was. And there was many more interesting things to sniff than people's legs and bags. But they were so disciplined, I had a nice pie which I was eating, and they never sniffed that at all. They just sniffed my bags. So that's very, very well-disciplined dogs. Well done, the dogs of Los Angeles. Could you do that? I'm sure you'd sniff my pie. That was you. A very delicious pie as well. Anyway, so there you've got some people freaking out. Oh, we're going to die. It's an explosion. The terrorists have got us. And there's other people just, you know, worrying about what's happening. I was enjoying my pie and actually had a very nice conversation with the man who was serving me this. I told him he had very good camera. He got me stuck there for 2 hours, just him and myself. We were supposed to go to his house, but couldn't go there. We were stuck there, so he had me to himself to offer dana, to offer all this food, just him and nobody else. And he taught, you know, meditation and Buddhism all the time. So it was a very, very nice little time we had together. So where everyone else was freaking out, we had a wonderful time. Now you see, this is how you deal with life. You know, when you're in a terrorist situation, have a pie and talk about Dhamma. So you can understand what I mean by talking about having a pie. I mean, you can't sort of do anything. You're going to get blown up. You're going to get blown up. So you're going to die sometime. So just stop messing around and just worrying about things. This is the problem of life. It's not being in a terrorist situation. It's not just being in an ordinary situation. It's how you're in these situations and what you do in that particular time. You know, sometimes people get sick and people just worry like hell about being sick. This was what I was told when I was a school teacher, because I was a school teacher for 1 year. I often say that's why I became a monk. Teaching high school is enough to make anyone leave the world. And when I was teaching at school, just beforehand, I was teaching science. And surely you know that one day some kid is going to sort of spill the acid over himself. You know, kids being kids. Or they're going to put some metal into the power source and electrocute themselves or something like that. And if it can happen, it will happen. And so if you're going to be the teacher in charge, you know, I want to know what to do. Give me some basic first aid. And I got the best piece of advice from this GP, who the students, we told, can we get a GP in, you know, a doctor, to tell us what to do in such emergencies? You know what he told us? He said, don't worry. You know, if you see a kid who's got a bad injury, he said, the first thing to do is to lie. Say, oh, that's not bad, you'll be okay. Now, this is really great advice. I mean, not to lie, I mean, but, you know, actually not to worry. I've got to be careful with this thing. Because he was saying, I'm not a doctor myself, I didn't do much in biology, but he was saying it is the shock which kills people more than anything else. If you see someone who's injured, you say, oh my God, look at that, that's terrible. Ah! How would that make the person feel? That certainly happened to me. I remember just as a young monk, I stepped on a nail and they went about 2 or 3 inches into my foot. A long way. It didn't hurt at all. It must have been one of those acupressure points which has got no pain. It just went in. That was interesting. But then the guy who was with me said, oh no, look at that. And as soon as he said that, it began to hurt. Stupid guy. I should choose my friends more carefully. But the point is, it was That was a good example, how I reacted to it. That was the problem. And you find much of life is there, if you know where to view. So you have a tragedy in life. You know, you're sick, you've got cancer. Or someone else is sick. For goodness sake, stop worrying about it. It's a worry which kills you. What was that wonderful piece of research? Because I really try hard to keep up. And so when people do get some really interesting research which is being done, they usually send it to me, or you download it from the internet, or you know, you read it in some magazine, that some research was showing that when people are diagnosed with cancer, the cancer suddenly gets very worse. And they know, I don't know how they know this, but they said that cancer has almost certainly been in that person for many years, but once they know it's cancer, then it starts to cause big trouble. It's obvious why, because people start worrying about it. They don't know how to relate positively to whatever they have to experience in life. So the right view is looking not, I've got cancer. Ah, my best friend is sick and going to die. Ah, I've lost all my money on the stock market. Ah, you know, my girlfriend has left me. Ah, or whatever else is happening. I don't know all these hours these days. Instead of your worry and getting upset about it, there's another way of dealing with it. First of all, you look where the action of life is. Where is the happiness and suffering of life? It's not in life itself, nor is it in you. The observer is pretty neutral. It's the way you observe, the way you react, the way you think. Which is why that when we look at that, that's what we're looking at when we do some meditation. Remember what I've been saying when we were meditating? It doesn't matter what the sounds are. It doesn't matter what the pain is. Embrace it. Be with it. Make peace with it. Know it. Understand it. And that's why I don't know how long I've been teaching meditation now. It doesn't matter at all whether you're in jhana or whether you are sleepy, whether you're restless, whatever you're thinking about, goodness knows whatever. What really is important is how you're doing that, how you're reacting to it, how you're relating to it. Even in meditation, it's what's between you and whatever you're experiencing right now. I call that meditation karma. I'm going off the track here, but meditation karma. There's good meditation karma and bad meditation karma. Good meditation karma, what's that? Just letting things be, being kind, being gentle, making peace. We all know, if you're a Buddhist, that's called good karma. Now, being kind is good karma, being gentle, being generous, and making peace. This is known worldwide what Buddhists are supposed to be. You're peaceful people, you're kind, you're gentle. Are you? That's what you're supposed to be. Maybe on the outside you are, but what's going on inside? Good meditation karma is no matter what you're experiencing, you're going crazy. Okay, I can make peace with that. I've been kind, gentle, the door of my heart's open to me going to Greylands or wherever you're going to go. Be kind to yourself. Be gentle. That's good meditation karma. What is bad meditation karma? I don't want this. It should be different. They should sort of make sure this place has got personal air conditioning. You know, we're building a retreat center. One of the proposals was to have personal air conditioning, like a tube which comes down just over every meditator and with an adjustment there. So you can have, you know, 22 degrees, 24 degrees. Of course you can't do that, no matter how much you try and control the environment. People get more frustrated the more control they have. Again, I'm going off all sorts of tangents on this talk, but this was a wonderful little anecdote we got from this retreat center, which was built in the United States a long time ago. They raised a lot of money, much more than they needed, I think. So they decided to make this really the best retreat center you can possibly get. They did everything, sort of state of the art, really comfortable, great food, great accommodation. And when they put it all together, then they decided, how can we make it even better? So they put in the complaints box or suggestions box. And what really surprised them was how quickly that suggestion box filled up with complaints. because they all knew they'd been to other retreat centres which were far from as good as this one. The worse they were, the less complaints they had. But when you get so close to perfection, that's when you really get upset, because it's just that little bit more. This is the problem with controlling. The more we try to control, we get so successful. That doesn't mean we let go of controlling, but we try and control even more. The more successful and accomplished we become. It's a great little piece of psychology, that. So, instead of trying to control so much our meditation, we let go, we make peace, become kind, we become gentle. Bad meditation karma is, I want, I have to get. And some people are incredibly aggressive. They fight their mind. They fight the pain. They sit there, I'm not going to move. This is what I did once, because I was very stupid as a young man. I'm not that smart now, but you know, as a young man I was really dumb. Because I heard, this was my first big Buddhist ceremony, the birth, enlightenment and final passing away of the Buddha. And my first one. And then I heard the story of the Buddha, who decided to sit down. He made this resolution. I will not move from my meditation seat until I achieve full enlightenment. Even though my blood dries up and my bones turn to dust, I will not move until I see the truth. That's really inspiring. So I thought, well, if the Buddha could do it, why not me? I'm as good as a Buddha. That's the arrogance of an 18-year-old. So I went back to my room. Straight afterwards, I got out my cushion and I sat down. I'd only ever managed 20 minutes meditation before. It's crazy how stupid you are. 20 minutes was my maximum, but I made that great determination. I am not going to move from this cushion until I too achieve enlightenment, because I was a busy man. I had many things to do in life. I want to get it out of the way. You know what it's like. Get it out of the way so you can go on to other things. So I will not move so I get full enlightenment. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up. I really meant it. I did. It lasted 40 minutes. Incredible agony. When I opened my eyes, I wasn't enlightened, and actually my blood hadn't dried up yet. That is controlling. That is force. That is bad meditation karma. Still many people do that, though. They're so aggressive and think they can get to this peace and freedom and wisdom through controlling things. That's bad meditation karma. Good meditation karma is just letting things be. Being kind, being gentle, not being aggressive. So even in meditation, where the action is, where you should be viewing, is not what you're experiencing, but how you're experiencing it. So you're tired. Be kind to your tiredness. Let it be. Make peace with it. So you've got a restless mind. Oh, it's just cause and effect. It's come from because you've been thinking a lot. Be kind to it. Be gentle. Let it be. That's called good meditation karma. And if you make good meditation karma looking at the where the action is, what's happening between you and the experience, and you put the good, you know what, you have the right view of how to work in that space, then of course you get the beautiful good results. It's incredible. I've been meditating for such a long time. This works. And it works really amazingly well. Of course it works. You make good meditation karma, you get good results. You make bad meditation karma, your meditation never happens. And it's the same with life. Doesn't matter who you're married to. Beautiful guy, ugly guy, nice woman, not so nice woman, or whatever, whoever you're married to. If you're married to your dog, I don't care. It's the relationship you have to that being. That's what's really important. What's between the two of you? When you view that, and that's where you put your attention. I said that's where the Four Noble Truths live. That's where the suffering is. in the relationships you have, in the space between what you have to deal with, and how you deal with that. Because if you have this craving, this wanting, this controlling, I don't want this, I want that, I don't want it to be this way, I want it to be another way, you really start messing up things. But if you have this beautiful love and embracing, sometimes people, when I talk like this, they start complaining. They say, yeah, but if you don't do something, you never get anywhere in life. Look, where have we got in life with all of our doing and controlling and making and planning? We plan so much that we miss the point. Planning. Why are you planning for the future? Because you think by thinking about it, by contemplating it, by planning it, you are going to have a better future. What happens? You just get big headaches and worries and stressed out. Anxiety disorders, panic disorders, simply because we miss the point that now is the place where the future is made. It becomes obvious when you put it that way. Where can you work to make a good future? Tomorrow? Next week? It's now. And so whenever we start planning the future, thinking what we're going to do tomorrow, what time we're going to go to the shops, you know, what we're going to buy, who we're going to meet, what we're going to have for lunch, what we're going to have for dinner. Sometimes you have to do that, but please minimize it, the absolute minimum. Because now is the place where you can actually make a future. The more peaceful, the more calm, the more gentle, the more kind you are right now, that's where you'll have a good future. Because this is making karma. We can't make karma in the future. The only way we can make karma is right now. So we make good karma, kindness, gentleness, peace. We're obviously going to have a beautiful future, so we trust this. That is why that, you know, even though I knew roughly the subject of my talk tonight, I haven't got any clue how I'm going to present the right view. It's not exactly the same. It's actually very different than the talk I gave in Toronto a week ago. I never plan talks which I give. Because I know planning the talks is not the best way to have a good talk. You put your energy in this moment, you're kind, you're gentle, you're peaceful, and then it all comes out. That's the way you can do stupid things like travel for 45 hours and give a talk right afterwards. You don't worry about it, you don't start thinking about it. There's something which is called conceptual proliferation. It's a beautiful word, it's called papancha in Buddhism. It's how we have something, we just think too much about it. We just consume our mind with what might happen. The classic story of this, which I wanted actually to put in Open the Door of Your Heart, but it was copyright and it couldn't get put in there because this was a story from that great English philosopher. Of all the philosophers, the 20th century, this was my favourite philosopher, Winnie the Pooh. The reason why it was very wonderful, it was down to earth, straight, and even children could understand it. But don't think this was children's philosophy. This is important, deep stuff. Once, Winnie the Pooh and his best friend Piglet were walking back from Rabbit's house where they'd had a nice afternoon tea. As they were walking back through the forest, the wind started to build up its ferocity. As they were still a long way from home, it became very clear that a storm was coming, and they would not get home in time. Now remember these two characters. Winnie the Pooh was someone who had hardly any education, and was also fat like me. There must be something with wisdom and being a bit overweight. And he had this innate wisdom, what we call in Buddhism the bare awareness. Oh, come on, that's a terrible joke. Anyway, I tried it. Anyway, his friend was this little guy, little piglet. And little guys are usually always anxious. You can understand why, because they're living in a big world and they're so tiny and vulnerable. So there was Piglet and Pooh walking together home from a nice afternoon tea. And a long way to go, and the storm got worse and worse. The rain wasn't the problem, but the wind was so strong that branches started coming off the trees. And then some even trees were being uprooted by the storm, and they still had a long way to go. And when these trees, or even the branches, they go thud, and they really make you scared. And so, little Piglet got more and more anxious, more and more afraid. And he was holding the paw of Winnie the Pooh tighter and tighter and tighter, until little Piglet held it so tight that even Pooh stopped. And Piglet turned around and said, "I can't go on any longer, I can't go on. I've been thinking, what would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it?" That's called fear. What would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? And that was a valid fear. That could happen. Trees were falling around. But the answer to that question came to Pooh very quickly. "Yes," he said, "what would happen if a tree fell when we were underneath it? But what would happen if a tree didn't fall when we were underneath it?" And that's all that was needed to overcome fear and to walk on in peace. Too often, we have this conceptual proliferation called worry and anxiety. What would happen if? And that's followed by some negative thing. You got cancer. What would happen if it got worse? Yeah, but what would happen if it got better? You know, you having a relationship which is getting difficult. What would happen if she left me? What would happen if she didn't? Someone I know is very, very sick and dying. What happens if they really die? Yeah, what would happen if they didn't? A lot of times, that because when we think of the future, we think with negativity, because we're negative conditioned beings, we always think of what might go wrong. And because we think of what might go wrong, we lose a lot of mental power, we lose a lot of happiness, and we lose a lot of peace. We make bad meditation, or bad mind karma, if you like. So if ever you are a person who is anxious, who fears things, if you think, what would happen if that biopsy, which is, I took yesterday, what would happen if that turns out to be malignant cancer? See if you can counter that by saying, what would happen if it didn't? You have that test. How are you relating to it? Why is fear always the negative expectation of what might go wrong? And why can't we just turn that around and say, what might go right? What might go well? What if the nice things were happening? And you will find if you start to expect the positive starts to happen. If you keep expecting the negative starts to happen. Which is why that doctor said it's a shock, it's a negativity. Look at that, that's terrible. Wow. When we add the negativity to life, that's when it goes wrong. So instead of reacting in a negative way, the right view, we see the situation we're faced with. This is me, this is what's happening. What am I putting in between those two? That way, it's amazing just how you can be effective, successful, happy and content in life. Instead of always fighting life, we can actually learn how to make peace and learn to guide life gently. Just in the same way that you train a sort of a dog to be a sniffer dog. Just like you train your children when they're growing up.
I've got a cramp. Well, I'm peaceful with the cramp.
I'm just going to put my leg out for a moment. just as You learn how to be kind and peaceful to sudden physical feelings which come into your body. And you can make a joke about it. In the same way that whatever happens to you in life, it's not what you experience, but how you're experiencing it. So the right view, putting your attention, not what you're experiencing, but how you're experiencing, and putting positive karma there. I've already mentioned the Four Noble Truths. If you look at conventional Buddhism, they say that right view is usually Four Noble Truths and understanding karma, and also say rebirth as well. So understanding karma is, this is where the action of life happens. This is where you can affect life and the present moment and also the future. If you understand the law of karma, it means it's what you're doing about what you're experiencing. That's actually what karma is. I know that sometimes people think, oh, it must have been bad karma. The Majjhima Brahma must have kicked an enlightened being in his past life. That's why he's got a crap now, but it's all gone anyway. That's not what the law of karma is. Karma is not retribution, as if you get punished for things you do wrong, or you get rewarded for things you do right. That's not the essential meaning of karma, because karma means action. It's what you're doing, but not just with your body, but with your speech and your mind, literally how you're reacting to life. So the law of karma is, how are you reacting with what you've got right now? So you're in an airport, and there's a terrorist scare. Great, you can have lunch. So you're late. You can have more time to have a Dharma discussion with your friend. So, you know, you lose some money. Great. You don't have so many things to worry about. Unless you lose too much, that is. So, you know, you get sick. What a wonderful teaching sickness is. You know, it teaches you to be humble. And as I mentioned quite often here, if you are sick, what a wonderful gift that is to other people, so that they can help and show their compassion and kindness to you. So sickness is an offering to other people. Here am I need to be cared for, be kind. What a wonderful thing that is. So, and even death is a wonderful thing to do. You know, making space for other people, making space in other people in life. Whatever happens, but if you do get sick and you did know you're going to die, what a wonderful thing that is. At least you know the time. You can prepare yourself. You can understand about what the nature of life is. So even death is not a problem. It's not dying is the problem. It's how you die. It's how you relate to that. The karma you put in with how you react and relate and deal with what you have to experience in life. You also have things like disappointments, the death of your hopes and dreams. Yeah, the things don't work out as planned. You know that. That's why I plan as minimum amount as I possibly can. I only look at my itineraries just a few hours before I go. So you don't look too much about what you're doing in the future. And you do a little bit of planning. I'm not saying you shouldn't plan at all. A little bit of planning, but don't overdo it. Because life, this is one of the sayings of the Buddha, life, or rather the, what is it, whatever you think it's going to be, it will always be something different. It's a great little saying, whatever you think it's going to be, it will always be different to that. So sometimes when I really understood what he meant by that saying, I didn't really plan too much. A lot of times when people do plan for their future, their plan is so solid, as if their plans have to happen. And when it doesn't happen, when it all sort of starts to change, people get so angry and frustrated. It's not the sort of the airline's fault that it's late. It's not your friend's fault that, you know, didn't turn up on time. This is life. You don't turn up on time sometimes. This life is like this. But we try and plan it to our schedule, and that causes immense frustration and also anger, which eats us up sometimes. Even we plan for our relationship to last a long time, and it doesn't. We plan for our children, you know, to sort of grow up, get a job, get married, or even better, become a monk or a nun. But it just doesn't work out that way sometimes. And we get frustrated and anger. So much anger is because of frustrated plans. And instead of having such hard and fast plans, we should just make them more plastic. So we can always change our plans at any moment. Just like when you give a talk, you can just change its direction at any moment. And that way you're not being fixed. When you don't fix your intention in life, you don't steer your course in a certain direction which you have to keep no matter what happens. When you are more able to react to the moment in positive, good, calmer ways, you find you become a much happier, more resourceful person. Instead of just having it all planned out from the beginning, you just allow nature to evolve and your decisions and your course to evolve as you see more and more of life. We're always getting more views. In other words, more information. Life is continually seeing deeper into things. So view is not static. Because our understanding is ever growing, how can we really make such strong plans or make such strong statements right now when we may get different, better information later on? We should always be able to change and amend our plans. If you can be one who can change and amend the plans, you know about what impermanence is. You don't have to always have things going in that direction which you planned and expected a long time ago. You can adapt. That's what I mean by adapting, is making peace, being kind, being gentle. Embracing life with all its twists and turns and unexpected events. Without anger, without upset, without being frustrated. I don't know how many times people say when they sort of, someone gets sick, or they lose their job, or they die, say, why did this happen to me? Why did this, wasn't as planned? I didn't expect this to happen. Even one long time supporter of this temple here died while I was overseas. When I heard the news, I expected it to happen. I didn't have some premonition this person was going to die. What it is, I knew that someone's going to die. That's my prediction. So someone's going to die tonight. So you expect people to die at any time. This is one of those little nice teaching lessons which you often do in a group of people. I don't know how many people are here this evening, maybe 300, maybe a little bit more than that this evening. But out of 300 people, at least 6 of you will be dead by this time next year. Just a quick statistical calculation. 6 of you will be dead by this time next year. Now the question is, which 6 would it be? And don't just look at the old ones. It could be you. And no one knows that's going to be them. So this is life. It happens that people die. If you can plan for that, what a wonderful thing it is. I can die at any time. That's my plan. I don't expect to live forever. I don't even expect to live for the next 30 years, or 10 years, or 10 days, or 10 minutes. Wow, that makes life interesting. What that means is our plans are tentative, and we understand we don't spend so much time looking into the future, nor do we spend so much time viewing the past. I don't know how many people are prisoners of the past. Who said what to who and why? Look, even if someone really gave you a hard time and did things they shouldn't have done or said things they shouldn't have done, why are you allowing that to spoil your day? One of the great insights was, I don't have to carry the past around. I can actually choose to carry which parts of the past around that I want. So I chose a long time ago, anything which is negative, which I didn't like. Just like if I have some food and you've got some sort of dirty parts, you've got a fly in the soup. If you've got a fly in the soup, do you eat the fly? Or do you take the fly out and just eat the soup? Well, it's like people, you know, they look at the past, they just eat the flies. You know, they've got all this available, you know, the soup or the fly, you know, from the past. What happened to you even today? And people just take the flies. Sometimes, and I give a talk, sometimes I say stupid things. I'm a stupid monk sometimes. I'm a great monk sometimes. Neither is me, I'm just a monk. But when I say stupid things, sometimes that's what people remember. They collect the flies in the soup. Other people are smarter. If I say something stupid, they'd push it aside, just eat the soup. Now, where we collect the past, that's what it's like sometimes. It's really ridiculous. If you are going to collect the past and think about the past, please collect the nice stuff. Any mistakes, difficulties, pain, disappointments, leave that alone. Don't carry it around with you and spoil the day. Just collect the nice stuff. And don't worry about the future. If you haven't got any fears, it's always what if that might happen. Say, what if it didn't? Probably even more probable. Very few people get hit by falling trees. Very few people actually get hit by lightning. But people are so afraid. What would happen if the lightning struck while we were outside? Very unlikely to happen. But many people are afraid of that. So when we learn how to deal with the future and the past, then we can actually have this beautiful view that the present moment is where the action is. Enjoying this moment more. Because sometimes I think you've worked so hard in your life, always preparing and thinking for the future. You worked hard when you were a kid, doing the examinations, working hard so you can have a good future. The future is now here. Can't you enjoy this moment? You've worked so hard for it. What do most people do? Now, instead of enjoying the fruits of their hard work right now, they go to discarding that as they think about an even better future, or a different future. Look, we plan for the future sometimes, so sometimes in the future we can have a nice time. Today is the future of your past. Right now is what you've been planning for all this time, you've been working hard for. Can't you just enjoy this moment? Spend some time not moving forward into the future, not lingering back, but being here and resting and enjoying the fruit of your karma by making peace, being kind, being gentle to this moment you've worked so hard for. You look in this moment. You look in this space. You look, this is right view. And in that space, you give it kindness, peace and gentleness. You let go. If you can do that, you have what's called right view. You understand karma. You understand the cause of suffering and the end of suffering. You can't control people. You can't even control yourself, can you? But at least you can make peace with yourself. You can always be kind to yourself. You can always be gentle. You can always make peace. That's something you can always do wherever you, whatever your situation you're in. Even in your dying moments, you can't sort of control the body anymore. You can't control your bladder, you can't control your bowels. Sometimes you can't even speak when you're sick and dying. But you can always make peace. You can always be kind. You can always be gentle. Now we know what right view is. Something you can do at any moment, any time. It's good karma. It has to lead to beautiful results. So when I look for the future, when I plan my future, I think if I want some happiness and peace and success, whatever else I want, I know the law of karma. By making peace now, by being kind, by being gentle, by letting things be, by doing that right now, I am planning the future, as it were. I am ensuring that my future will be wonderful, joyful, free and easy, because I know the future is made now. And how I make it? Good karma. That's called right view. And that leads to freedom, to peace. What do you want in life? Isn't it this wonderful peace of mind, sense of freedom, this beautiful kindness and love? You can't make love by making war with yourself or with others. If you make peace, you make love, you make kindness, you let things be right now, you are building what I call the house of peace, the house of kindness, the house of love. A house is made of many bricks, each laid one by one. The house of peace is made by many moments of peace, laid one after the other. Like the house of kindness, like the house of freedom. By making freedom in every moment, as much as you can. There you understand what right view is and how it leads to perfect peace and perfect freedom, to enlightenment itself. So there you go. There's something to contemplate. Right view. Thank you for listening. Okay. Sorry, I'm a bit too close to the microphone. I hope the sound was okay, especially when I had a bit of cramp, which is all gone. Okay, has anyone got any questions or comments about this evening's talk about right view? Any questions or comments? Going. One over there. Oh, yeah. Oh, from good old Lawrence. Sir Lawrence. Okay, that's being kind, being peaceful, being gentle. Like, a good example of that is, say, Mahatma Gandhi. He was peaceful, he was kind, he was gentle. And he actually kicked out the British from India. No one else would have been able to do that. So sometimes it may be the quietism is not quiet enough. I don't know, it's an interesting question. Because sometimes riders, I do read the newspapers on the aircraft, and to see, let's say, being political in Zimbabwe, it's a mess. And it's just, how can that mess be solved? It's a difficult question. That's one of the reasons I never got into politics. Get into sort of being a monk instead. It's much easier. That's right, never cooperated, but he was never violent, and was always kind, and was always even understanding of the mind of an oppressor. Which is, I know that's something from the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, because one of the things, which the great poems he wrote, was actually about the boat people from Vietnam coming over to places like Australia, who were very brutally raped and robbed by Thai Buddhist pirates. They're supposed to be Buddhist, but they're obviously just superficially Buddhist. No human being deserving of that term would do such things. But he wrote this wonderful poem, I can't remember it in detail, but something sort of, I am the woman who's lost everything, who's in the boat tossed in the seas, raped and robbed by the pirates. And I am the pirate who rapes and robs her. Now I am the person, you know, who has nothing to eat. But I am also the great merchant who's, because of their profit, means they haven't got anything to eat. He did a wonderful little thing there of not just criticizing, but understanding. It's such a hard thing to do, but such an important thing to do, to understand the mind of a dictator. And with that understanding, maybe there's a way past that, through that, to transcend it, to solve the problem. But actually to be in that very difficult position by putting yourself in the mind of someone who does such things. Understand them. and then maybe we can have some solution. It's an interesting possibility. Remember, right view is always changing, adapting, growing. It's never fixed. So my right view in these things is always changing, adapting. So a different thing every week sometimes. And that's so it should be. So if you're coming here looking for dogma, in no way, you're not going to get ex cathedra. Ajahn Brahm says this, because I'll say something different next week. Yes, good thing. Yeah, okay, yes. When we were going past the... This is a long time ago. It's an interesting situation. We had clay trucks coming past our monastery creating a lot of noise, but even worse, and this is the main reason why I kept fighting this, was it was dangerous. It was a very dangerous situation, especially when I saw trucks turning over on the side. Dangerous, not just for the monks, but for all of you who would come to visit from time to time. And I thought I had a responsibility there to do something, but to do it with gentleness, with kindness. I remember just one of the monks there, and I thought, what a beautiful gesture. He sent Christmas cards one year to the people who were fighting. So, you know, these were our adversaries. He said, have a Merry Christmas. And we got a letter back saying, wow, that blew me away. You know, you're fighting court cases with us. And then you sent a Christmas card, Merry Christmas. And we meant it. It wasn't sort of some legal strategy.